extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Welcome, everyone, to an extra special edition of Club & Country Qatar 2022 right here on the Extra Time channels as well as the MLS YouTube page. We are going to be here all the way through the World Cup. November is coming. In fact, it's only 60 days away. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, Charlie Davies. You know him well. Charlie, you scored a goal on Azteca. Let me just get that out of the way. We don't have to mention it on this show anymore. Matt Doyle and David Goss here as well. We're going to go through ahead of these friendlies, the final friendlies for the U.S. and Canada ahead of the World Cup. What's going on with both teams, whether it's the roster, players called in, players not called in, what it all means, how it pertains to the final 26 that Greg Berhalter and John Herdman will choose ahead of the big tournament. And we'll look into these friendlies. What should you be thinking about? What are those coaches thinking about? What could come of these games and what will it mean over the next 60 days when we already know so much can change? I've said 60 days over and over. Wow, it's only 60 days away. It feels like we're almost here, that those are just going to melt away. Charlie, how do you feel, man? How do the players feel, you think, right now?
Excited. I think they believe in the group. If you were to watch them, just the way they are around each other, the way they kind of were able to get out of World Cup qualifying and there were so many ups and downs, I think there's a lot of hype and optimism heading into the World Cup, especially when you have your backs against the wall because no one thinks you're beating England. And people are still questioning if they can beat Wales. And everyone's saying, hey, Iran in 98, they gave us a tough test. This is a difficult team. They're going to sit in a low block. You got to break them down. So I think knowing the challenges in front of them, that they're excited. And I'm excited, too. I'm pumped for the World Cup.
We're analyzing this, but ultimately we're also fans. And we didn't get, for the U.S., the last one in Russia in 2018. We didn't make the tournament. What are we doing? We weren't there. We weren't watching our team. And Canada has waited three decades on the flip side, Dave. So you're a guy that goes to World Cups. You like that experience. You want to be on the ground. I don't think that's happening for you this time around, but you still have the experience with both the U.S. and, of course, your adopted nation up north.
And I would argue if you don't go to a World Cup, even if you do, the two best places in the world to watch a World Cup might be New York City and Toronto. So I'm not that stressed about it. And it's really cool. I read Josh Cloke's book. He's coming out with a book called The Voyagers about sort of Canada's push to this moment. And that gave me a lot more insight into what the country as a soccer nation has gone through, how they ended up here. And the thing that I've talked about on this show, and I think we've all talked about, is how the team represents the country truly to a man individually. That hasn't always been the case about the national team. And now it is. And now they're succeeding. And now they are the most Canadian thing in the world. They're underdogs. They're going to face a bunch of countries that couldn't find them on a map to a bunch of people who don't know where Ottawa or Edmonton are even located. And I think that's where Canada really shines. So that's exciting. And these rosters coming out, it's like, oof, we're there. Like, it's not just like, oh, let's talk in theory about nine moves away when Brendan Aaronson ends up on X club. What will he look like in 2022? It's now.
No, we're not there, Doyle. You probably know that better than anybody else. So I say 60 days until the World Cup and you think decision day, MLS Cup playoffs,
yep.
MLS Cup. You're like 60,000 words that I'm going to write. But this is going to creep up and it'll be here. Where are you right now in sort of your mental process ahead?
I'm locked in on this camp. I'm really interested in seeing what's to come from these two games, from the U.S. national team and from Canada as well. I think it'll hit me after camp. It had, like, I don't have nerves about the national team at this point. I don't, you know, like, I'm not tearing my hair out about anything at the moment. I just want to see these games. I think after that second game is done and we've had 48 hours to digest it and we've all, you know, pumped out new content and analysis and all that, then I think it's going to hit me. And that's when it's like, oh God, okay, Gio Reyna's hamstrings. Okay, is Pulisic beating guys off the dribble again? Okay, Josh Sargent still scoring. Like, it going to be watching that like a hawk as we try to juggle and manage the decision day and the, you know, the home stretch in MLS and then the playoffs and everything that comes with that. So yeah, a week from a week from today, probably going to be feeling very different.
So obviously in this international break, less MLS coverage from us on Extra Time. This is part of the Club and Country Qatar 2022 sort of vertical that we're going to be doing throughout the World Cup. We have watch-along shows for all these friendlies for U.S., Japan. Charlie, Michael Parkhurst, myself will be watching that one in the bright, early, bushy hours of the morning. Here it'll be 7:25 Central Time rules, as always. But for you East Coasters, 8:25 is the time on that one. ESPN2, ESPN+, Unimas, TUDN. We'll be on YouTube and Twitch on that one. Same thing for USA Saudi Arabia on Tuesday, also on YouTube and Twitch. You can watch that one on FS1, Unimas, and TUDN at 2 p.m. Eastern or 1 p.m. Central Time. Canada's got two matches as well, Qatar and Uruguay, both those on Friday and Tuesday as well. So coverage coming on MLS today for those as well as other places. And we're going to have these club and country shows all the way through the World Cup. I believe MLS today will sort of morph into daily coverage of the World Cup led by the one, the only, David Goss. Go check out that podcast feed, or you can listen live on Twitch. Extra Time will be with you every step of the way. We will obviously have watch-alongs for every single one of those World Cup games for as long as the World Cup goes for the U.S. and Canada. Knock on wood. Whether it's the group stage, knock on wood, or all the way to the knockout round somewhere, we hope we will be with you every step of the way. But for now, as Doyle said, it's all about these friendlies. It's all about trying to figure out who the 26 are. Let's start with you, Charlie. Let's start with the U.S. What do they need to get out of this window? What are sort of the big pictures, paint with a broad brush? Like, what are the check boxes for Greg Berhalter and this team?
Well, due to some injuries, and in particular Chris Richards, the center back pairing, people were always apt to you know, want to see Chris Richards alongside Walker Zimmerman. Now it looks like it's going to be Aaron Long. So, you know, figuring out what that back line looks like, and particularly the center back, and Anthony Robinson's out now, so looks like Sam Vines will get the start. And then we all want to know who the number nine is. Ricardo Pepi comes in, you know, brought into camp. It seems like he's now getting his confidence back in Holland. Josh Sargent is thriving in the championship right now, and Jesus Ferrer has been doing it all season long with FC Dallas, 6 goals in his last 6 matches. So I think Ferreira still holds the key to that position in terms of how he fits into Greg Berhalter's system.
You mentioned names that are here. The names that are sort of getting people riled up now are the names that are not here, and that's the way it works with World Cup rosters. It's often who doesn't get called up, who is not on that final roster that gets the emotions flowing. Of course, PFOC and Brandon Vasquez not in this camp. Greg Berhalter told us right here in Extra Time, look, we're not bringing 6. So don't think that's going to happen. We'll dig into that more a little bit later as we dig into the rosters for both teams. But for Canada, Dave, it doesn't feel like maybe the highs of qualifying right now. It feels like a little bit more uncertainty given what happened in June with those friendlies that got disrupted by some of the negotiations going on with the Federation and the players. They're not on the same form, maybe injuries playing a role. Where is John Herdman's head right now?
Yeah, I think when Canada qualified, everything was great. Everyone was playing at a high level at their club. There was depth, there was options, and I would argue nothing is as good as it was at that time now. And the panic comes twofold. One, as you mentioned, the issues with the Federation, the issues with organization, the issues with planning for your first World Cup in 36 years. And then the other side, which is the players and what they're doing with their clubs. Multiple players have moved clubs. Kyle Larin not playing week in and week out, not a starter right now. This was a guy who almost led the planet in goals scored in qualifying, and I'd argue was maybe their most important player. Richie Larea went to Nottingham Forest. It didn't go well. And you look in central midfield, that's the real concern. Atiba Hutchinson is the backbone emotionally, experience-wise, of this team. He's injured. There's more going on at Besiktas, it sounds like, on top of the injury as well. His replacements, Jonathan Osorio, he is no longer part of this camp. He is injured. The next replacement up, Marc-Anthony Kay. The last time we saw him, he got a red card in World Cup qualifying. He proceeded to have his worst MLS season that we've seen since he emerged with LAFC in Colorado, traded to Toronto, picked up another injury, is finally back. And of note, for all of the guys on teams that aren't going to make the MLS playoffs, if you're injured, you're coming back, you've only got 2 more games before you go to the World Cup for the first time ever for all these Canada guys. So there's a level of panic, I think, in central midfield. And there's a level of panic, I think, overall. You're hearing John Herdman, I think, be stable about it, but admit it. He's not even trying to hide it. And that's where you're at when you look at this Canada team and sort of what they need to accomplish is a lot tactically, but the biggest one might just be emotionally. come out of this camp with that feeling again of like, yep, us against the world. We can make some funny things happen.
We'll see if they can get that done. Two big games for them, Qatar and Uruguay. Uruguay, a big test. We'll dig into that a little bit more later, as well as to Japan and Saudi Arabia for the U.S. Let's go into the rosters, because you know we're talking about these games, but ultimately the context under which all these conversations is happening is who are going to be the players, the group available to each coach? How does that affect their ability to succeed at the World Cup and get to the ultimate goal, which is to get out of that, as Greg Berhalter sort of described it, the first tournament, so to speak, and into the second one where anything could happen. That can be positive and negative, obviously. Well, the U.S. side, Doyle, is where we'll start. And I want your general thoughts on the roster with these sort of like guardrails included here, which is that Jedi is not here. Tim Weah is there, but he is not available to play. He is hurt. You know, Yunus Musa is not there, a late pull from this camp. Johnny Cardoso came in and replaced him. CCV, Cameron Carter-Vickers, and as Charlie mentioned, Chris Richards, both out with injuries. Those are big blows. So you have all these different players coming in to replace. I mentioned Cardoso. In the center back side of it, you have Eric Palmer-Brown and Mark McKenzie. Mark McKenzie getting another chance after a really strong season at Genk. You have the strikers that are not there. You have Malik Tillman coming in. What do you make of this group of 26 that Greg Berhalter has called, with also the inclusion of Berhalter's comments, which is like, this is not the final group. Like, he even said anything can happen from when we announce our roster on November 9th, and then FIFA makes us lock it in on the 14th, which, right. I mean, that's got to be a sort of a, you know, mental test for players, even to be 9th to 14th. Hold on. Wait a second. What about this 26? What does it say?
I mean, between the 9th and 14th, the way it goes with this group, half a dozen of them could pick up an injury. You know, that's what we saw like 2 weeks ago. Musa, Richards, Weah, all arguably starters. Well, Weah was already hurt, but Musa and Richards picking up these little knocks just before camp. I thought Cameron Carter-Vickers, I didn't think he was good in June, but he had played his way in. All this stuff, it just piles up. So it does open the door to opportunities for some guys. I remain surprised that Brandon Vasquez is not one of those guys who got an opportunity. Between him and Jordy Pefuk, those two guys are big traditional target strikers, traditional number nines, the type of guys who, okay, don't necessarily fit Greg Berhalter's game model, which fair enough, right? He has a plan of action and he wants to stick to it. And I think that's a good thing all in all, but you have to throw the plan out eventually in a lot of games, and come the 75th, 80th minute, if you're chasing a result, you want to bring on somebody who can get the job done in the box, who can, you know, win the first header, win the last header, put the ball in the net. And that's what, you know, Jordy Pefuk and Brandon Vasquez, these two guys in particular, are so much better than the three strikers who are in camp at doing that exact thing. So looking at it, I'm disappointed that one or the other isn't there, especially because both of these guys have earned it with their play over the past year. And I know that Pefuk has struggled with the national team, but like he went from being what, the leading scorer in Switzerland, to now putting up good numbers in the Bundesliga. So you got to throw out the game model for the depth pieces, man. Like, you got to think about what happens in the 80th minute. So my first takeaway in terms of looking at the roster was a little bit of shock that there's no target man for that exact situation.
Like it or not, the nine is just going to dominate conversations.
Yeah.
Charlie, that's just the way it goes. You know that better than most. Does Pefuk have a chance to get into this team for the World Cup? Greg Berhalter said as much in a quote, saying, hey, like, this isn't the end for Jordy. Like, it could still happen for him. We know what we get from him. But to not be in this camp when the first game is in Germany, where you ply your trade, And he said, I mean, he had a quote the other day about whether or not Greg or a staff member came to see and scout his game in person. He's like, I'm pretty sure they weren't here. Like, there's some like signals being sent. Do you think it's fair to say Pefuk is no chance to be on that World Cup roster, or could it happen? Or could we unmute our microphone?
We could unmute our microphone. I'm going to go with, I still think it can happen. I mean, he's scoring goals for the top team in the Bundesliga, not just any team, the top team. And what makes, I think, him super successful is because he's playing with two strikers. He's not the lone striker. He has that support system, and his partner has 6 goals and 4 assists in 7 matches. So someone who is a little more dynamic, which opens up pockets, and you just rely on him to get in the box, put himself in good positions and score. I think given the system that we're playing in, maybe that's not going to a good fit for him. However, you can't plan for everything, because that's what's so beautiful about our game. Sometimes in such situations, you have to change your philosophy. You have to change your tactics. You have to adjust. Maybe you have to play with 2 strikers. And guess what? That's the perfect player to bring in a situation where you need a goal. You need a big body, somebody who's going to throw their body in the box and get on the end of things. So I would be surprised if he continues to play and score goals. And his last match against Wolfsburg, where he had the game winner and a 2-0 win, he played 87 minutes. He had not played anywhere near 87 minutes up until that point. So he's building his match fitness. He's showing that he has stamina, that he can be a starter in a national team game. So for me, you leave the door open. And if he keeps performing, you bring him. That's not even a question. You bring him. You drop off. You have three right backs in this camp. You can't bring 3 right backs. You have Dest, Yedlin, Cannon. One's got to go. You're not bringing 3 right backs to a World Cup. I mean,
they
sorry.
Got 4. Joe Scally's in this camp too.
Right. But Joe Scally's probably going to be left back for Sam Vines. So in my opinion, you can't bring extra right backs and not bring a striker. Come on now.
Look, Charlie's running, running TSA security, looking right. at me like, listen, you can put it in the bin, but you can only bring 2 right backs through
security. That's it. Maximum.
Yeah. Charlie just wants to build the whole team out of strikers at this point.
Meanwhile, they're kind of waving through. Ricardo Pepi's getting waved through. They're like, you're good, man. And, you know, Josh Sargent, via his form, is in as well. Charlie, what do you make of Pepe's inclusion? He just got his first goal in a year at club level, but he's done it for Greg. It sort of feels like writing's on the wall that he is going.
Yeah, he's going. I don't think there's
I don't
any
think
doubt.
That's decided. I don't think that's decided.
There is no doubt he's going to the World Cup.
I think there
is no doubt.
I think what Greg Berhalter is doing, which I think is wrong in this situation, is being a club manager where he's managing Pepe's emotions, confidence to get the best out of him and try and spur him to score goals. If he comes out of forget how he plays in this camp. If he comes out of this camp and doesn't score goals, he's not going to the World Cup. But the point is, Greg Berhalter wants him to. If he's scoring and PFOC scoring, he's 100% going. So to the earlier point, PFOC doesn't control his own destiny. Ricardo Pepi does, and he controls both their destinies with the way he plays over the next 2 months.
What I'm telling you is he scored a goal before he even got into this camp. They're having conversations. If Greg Berhalter called Pepi and said, guess what? I'm not bringing you to this camp because you just got to your club. I want you to continue to keep doing your thing. If you play the rest of the year, you're going to go to the World Cup. He could have easily done that, and Ricardo Pepi could have easily said, you're right. I just got here. I'm building my confidence. I get it. I understand. I haven't done it. But he brought him because he sees him going. He has trust and faith in what Ricardo Pepi can bring to this team. And let's also be honest, he's very different than Jesus Ferreira and Josh Sargent, what he brings to the table. So I like it, and I'm all for it because we know his potential. We also know when he's just in form and he's producing, that's who you want on the pitch for me out of these three. So given that, I'm not shocked or surprised at all that Ricardo Pepi got this call up, because he made the move he needed to make to get the playing time to get him his confidence back. And I think the Dutch league is the perfect step, one step back to move 2 steps forward.
So before we turn the positional page, we haven't talked much about Josh Sargent, but he's been in incredible form, his best form as a striker, period, as a professional. I think it's easy to say, Doyle.
Yeah.
What's his chance of making this team? Like he is a little bit different from both these guys. He can swing out to the wing. What's his chance?
Don't throw wing, please. Keep it central.
I don't think versatility plays into it. I think he's only being looked at as a striker. I still think that Josh Sargent has the highest ceiling of any U.S. number 9 in the pool. Right, whether it's PFOC who's producing in the Bundesliga, or Pepi, who's I think probably just a more natural finisher, or Ferreira, who does this wonderful number 9 stuff. Sargent can actually, in theory, give you all of that because he's so smooth dropping into pockets to receive the ball, doing the Ferreira stuff, right? He has really good vision. He's really good on the half turn. He's much more rugged in the air than I think people realize. Now, he's not Bivak level, but he's close. He's a really good athlete. He's not going to, you know, sprint away from everybody, but he's a really good athlete. The thing that held him back for literally 4 years was that he did not make good runs. He did, like, you have to make goal scoring runs to be a consistent goal scorer. And manager after manager put him out there on the field and said, you're not doing that. You're going to play on the wing, or you're going to play in sort of the two line in a 3-4-2-1. You're going to play like this half attacking midfielder, half winger, you know, pocket winger type of thing. And like, he was good enough defensively and good enough on the ball to get major minutes doing that, but he wasn't productive at all. Well, yeah. When Pukki got injured back in August, he finally got a run of games at center forward, and he started making those runs. And it's not the transition moments, right? He scored a couple of really nice transition goals. It's the runs where Norwich were in possession, where they were knocking the ball around in the attacking third, and Sargent was, first of all, clean touches, good feet, and then boom, darting into the box, getting on the blind side of the defender, one touch finishing. He had never done that as a professional. He had never shown that as a professional. And every great goal scorer that we've ever seen, other than Messi, their goal scoring ability is built on that. And he's starting to show it. So he, like, to me, it's an open competition between these three guys in camp. And it, like, I think Sargent has the highest upside of all of them.
All right, we've gotten down the number nine rabbit hole here. I'm going to pull us out of it, and Dave, I'm going to throw it to you. So Doyle's disappointed. We don't see Brandon Vasquez. We don't see Pifok. Who are you disappointed not to see in this 26-man group for Greg Berhalter?
I'd say from the original list, it was Pifok. But then once the injuries happened and you got that next set of call-ups, I thought for Yunus Musa the replacement would be Eric Williamson. This is a guy who started in a Gold Cup final less than a year and a half ago. And when you look at, I think, Luca Della Torre's first up in replacing in that central midfield spot, but then you go one down, Eric Williamson is probably as like for like as you can get for Yunus Musa, right? A guy who's a progressive dribbler, who can break lines with his dribbling, who can affect defenses with the ball at his feet, who can drop in next to a defensive mid and help defensively, but pick up the ball from that area, which we saw Yunus Musa do so well, especially in the summer camp. And I'm watching him in MLS right now, and he looks back. Whether it's the quality on the ball, whether it's the ground he covers, whether it's the ability he has to look like the game's easy for him and everyone else is going in slow motion, all of that is back. And it's not been as long as you'd like because of the injury and the nature of how long it took. But it felt like once you went down from Musa, Roldan is hurt, instead of Johnny Cardoso, a guy who has not been around this group, has not been around the players or Greg Berhalter for a really long time, as much as he's playing in Brazil. I felt like Eric Williamson should have gotten that opportunity. He was name dropped by Greg Berhalter on the original roster release as he's a guy we're watching and interested in and talking to. And it just felt like here was an opportunity to see, is he back at the international level? And if not, understandable, but this is where you get your opportunity to see that. And it feels like he could have been a difference maker for them potentially off the bench.
No Musa, big disappointment here. Of course, the MMA midfield is what we've sort of built up over the course of qualifying here, but that's a huge disappointment not to have him here as well. No Zach Steffen either in this camp. And Charlie, I kind of thought it was injury, but it doesn't seem like it is injury. He's back at Middlesbrough trying to get training, trying to get back into this team, but it looks like it's Matt Turner's job. I mean, just from the outside looking in, the timing, the storylines, the playing time for Steffen evaporating a little bit in the championship. This feels like Matt Turner's opportunity slash his job.
Yes, I would say it's Matt Turner's job to lose at this point, just because Zach Steffen made the move to Middlesbrough to guarantee playing time, yet it's kind of been nullified with injury. So that was what was going to take him over the top to guarantee him that number one spot versus Matt Turner, who made the move to Arsenal because he wanted to be on a level playing field with Zach Steffen. So you couldn't use that argument of he's training every day with top players. So now that Matt Turner is in that environment and he's getting a game here and there, Matt Turner is the one just because Zach Steffen hasn't played. So in terms of those two, I think that's it's set in stone that Matt Turner's got to be the one.
I just want to make it. I want to make a point that how Matt Turner plays in these two games, and I assume he's going to get all 180 minutes. It's like it might be the most crucial thing that we learn out of this camp, because barring an injury to Aaron Ramsdale, he's not going to be getting regular minutes between now and November. Turner might play a half dozen games at most before the start of the World Cup. Some goalkeepers we've seen over the years have the ability to shake off rust, walk out into the field for the national team, and play lights out. We don't know if Matt Turner is that guy. We've literally never seen him in that situation. If he comes out and he has two shaky games, if he looks like Zach Steffen did, because I think it's indisputable at this point that sitting on the bench for Man City for 2 years made Zach Steffen a worse goalkeeper. If that happens to Matt Turner, that becomes a much bigger issue than the number nines. It becomes a much bigger issue than the center backs. It becomes a much bigger issue than who's the backup left back. It's like, oh God, we can't keep the ball out of the net. So two strong games for Matt Turner right here. Fingers crossed, boys.
I would add to what Doyle said. I completely agree with you, but he will actually get more games than he has, because the entire group stage of Europa League or Europa Conference, whichever one they're in, is going to happen before the World Cup, the EFL Cup. And then with the delayed games last week or 2 weeks ago, because of the Queen's funeral and everything else, there's more of a fixture congestion. So I would add just Turner has the opportunity to play well here and then jump off that by having more games and more chances to continue to show that he's good enough, which could be a really good stretch for him going into the World Cup.
Go ahead and mark off fixture congestion on your bingo cards, folks. We just check that one off right there.
God save the queen, you know.
I liked it. I enjoyed it. Center back's a big question mark as well. We mentioned it. You don't have Chris Richards. You also don't have CCV here. So it's more of a depth question probably, where Richards was pushing for that second starting spot next to Zimmerman. I would have really liked to see him get an opportunity in one of these games to show that as well. We won't get that opportunity. We'll talk more about that in our starting lineups, what that means for the U.S. But let's jump to, Doyle, your current 26-man roster. We have the 26-man roster that is here right now, but Greg made it clear a lot of things can change. So take us through right now who are sort of locks, who are definitely there, and where is the sort of the line between in and out as you see it now?
I mean, assuming full health, right? I have Weah and Reyna both at right wing. One of those guys will start. One will come off the bench basically every game, I think. Like, you can't trust either of them to play 270 minutes over the course of a week in the group stage. So I think that will be right wing. I have it Ferreira, Sargent, and Pepe at center forward. I think that David's right. If Charlie's right. If Pepe keeps scoring, he's going to be here. And Ferreira is, we barely touched on it, he's still probably the starting number nine. Left wing, there's going to be a little bit of an issue here. I have Pulisic, Aronson, and then Jordan Morris. I have Jordan Morris basically getting the last spot on the roster ahead of Paul Areola. I have Weston McKennie and Tim Tillman. Malik Tillman in central midfield on one side, and then Musa and De La Torre on the other. Tyler Adams, Kellen Acosta at D-mid. I don't think there's any question about that. Right back, I have Serginho Dest, Reggie Cannon, and DeAndre Yedlin. I have Cannon.
Three of them, Charlie. You count that.
I have three of them going. Cannon, because he's been playing a lot of right center back.
Yeah.
So he ends up being your fifth string center back on this roster. Yedlin goes because, first of all, against better competition, if Dest hasn't been available, Berhalter's pretty consistently turned to DeAndre Yedlin. That's one. And two is that he's the only guy on this roster who has World Cup experience. So I think he ends up going, even if he's unlikely to get on the field. Walker Zimmerman and Cameron Carter-Vickers at right center back. I have Chris Richards starting and Aaron Long backing him up at left center back. And then the other point of content, well, I'll say Turner, Steffen, Horvath at goalkeeper, though I would choose Sean Johnson, but I think Horvath will get the nod. And then at left back, I have Sam Vines backing up Anthony Robinson. I think Vines, because he's a like-for-like left-footer who goes end line to end line, creates width and attacking penetration, and the U.S., we're so reliant upon that. I don't think we can afford to go to the World Cup with either Dest or Scally as the backup left back. So I think the final cuts are going to be guys like, Paul Areola and Joe Scally, most likely.
All right. We will see. that is still a couple months away here. Of course, November 9th is the day in New York City that Greg Berhalter and the U.S. will announce their roster, but they don't have to be locked in for five more days. Knock on wood, injury-wise. We hope that everybody heals, plays, and thrives in the months in between. Let's turn to Canada now. Speaking of injury issues.
I thought we were going to do a best 11.
Oh, no, we're going to get there. It's Just hold your horses. Right. Charlie, I know you got your best 11 ready for Japan.
I was ready to jump.
I know. You're ready to go.
Charlie muted his rundown, so he just wasn't.
Oh, yeah.
We'll be back. We'll be back. We'll be back, Charlie. Don't you worry about it. He's still reeling from the three right backs on Doyle's 26-man roster there. How can this be?
I'm still reeling from Ethan Horvath respect for Matt Doyle.
Hey, this is not what I would choose. This is what I think Berhalter's going to choose. Uh-huh. Understand that this is what I think Greg will pick. I would be doing it differently.
I'm sure that will come out. Horvath
is clutch.
He's error prone, Charlie.
People keep forgetting his Nations League final.
Oh, sorry. Did Sean Johnson not win two penalty kick shootouts to win MLS Cup like 1 year ago?
Are we talking about Horvath in the Nations League final against Mexico?
Saved one penalty one time.
In that situation,
Charlie,
that's what you want as a backup goalkeeper.
They went head to head this summer, mm-hmm. and Horvath tripped over his boots and fell on his face. And Sean Johnson was the man of the match against Uruguay.
What I'm telling you is,
but Uruguay's not a big team.
What I'm telling you is, Horvath came in as a substitute in a dire situation that will be goes forever in terms of trust in a backup keeper. Sean Johnson or Horvath are not playing in the World Cup. They're not playing. They're not getting a game. They're not getting a minute. However, if there's some rare, bizarre situation scenario and you want to depend on someone coming in cold, Horvath, that is proof that you can rely on a Horvath to come in and change the game or at least keep you in the game. That's my point. I'm not saying Sean Johnson is not better than Horvath or Horvath is better than Sean Johnson. What I'm telling you is, as a coach, that memory will stick with you forever. And that is probably why your third keeper will be Ethan Horvath, as well as he's playing every week.
Here's a preview of your November 9th narratives, folks. Get your campaign signs and your buttons ready. Choose your sides. Let's talk Canada, Dave. We mentioned the injuries for the U.S. That's a bummer. Injuries for Canada, also a big bummer. Atiba Hutchinson dealing with some sort of bone bruise that's prevented him from being in any sort of fitness and playing at all, as well as much more, which I'll let you get into in a second. Jonathan Osorio, a late scratch from this camp. He's having neurological issues after, I think, what was a head injury for him. Mm-hmm. Daniel Henry, hamstring. David Witherspoon, knee. Other guys coming back from injury, like Mark Anthony Kay. What is going on from an injury standpoint with this team and the roster that John Herdman was able to put together? And then please just try to walk me through what is going on with Atiba in Turkey.
Yeah, to be clear, it's an unknown. One, I don't speak Turkish. And two, it's Turkish soccer. So it's chaos in its own right. All we've ever heard was that Atiba was a club legend. It was announced that he would be coming back for one more year on a one-year contract. What I'm getting is that he agreed to the contract, had not signed it. Besiktas just then turned around and said, we actually don't have enough international spots to bring you in. Again, I don't know why Atiba doesn't have domestic status at this point. He's only been there for 9 to 10 years. And then the fans came out and pushed the club and said, you have to respect Atiba. You have to guarantee his contract. From that moment, he got injured with the, as you said, the bone bruise. And they're saying he can't run on that foot and he has not played. To me, the Canadian medical staff going to Turkey to check him out, and rumors are that he's actually flown back to Canada to get looked at, that doesn't bode well for the trust level with Besiktas, that Besiktas is being above board about this entire thing and handling it the way you want to. Either way, it feels fairly safe to say that if Atiba's healthy, he will not have played soccer going into the World Cup. The friendly against Japan the week before they open up against Belgium in Dubai might be his first game since the summer when he played with the national team. So that is completely worrying for this team. He's a legend. He has started all of their big games at center mid. And when you look at this team, I think Steven Eustachio behind Alphonso Davies is the second most important player on this team. The way he controls the pace of play, the way he's able to get them out of trouble. If you watch the Gold Cup last year when Alphonso Davies and Jonathan David were not there, they should have beaten Mexico. And it was all down to the play of Steven Eustachio and Tejan Buchanan. But he has limitations to his game. his partnership in central midfield is almost as important as what he does well. Atiba has stepped in and he's done that at a high level. We saw Marc Anthony Kay do it at the beginning of qualifying in some big games, but again, he's been injured. He hasn't played well this year. He struggled in that big moment in Costa Rica. That's the last time we've seen him really at this level. And then Jonathan Osorio has stepped into that role as well, or he's played as a quote-unquote 10 who gives a little bit more cover to Eustáquio in that three-man midfield. Again, he's injured. He will only play at most two more games for TFC before he heads to the World Cup and heads to the Middle East. So all of that is worrying. There's some depth behind that. It's Sam Piette, who's been a loyal part of this team and is the leader. He's probably not a guy you want to see on a field against Belgium, Croatia, or now I can't Morocco. Remember. Yep. Yeah, there you Morocco. Go. Yep. And then Ismaël Koné is the other part of the conversation. There's a chance Ismaël Koné is the best player on the soccer field when he steps out there, even against these teams. There's a chance he's the worst player on the soccer field when he steps out against some of these teams. You don't want to have to play him from the start. He's a break if necessary, and if he's confident, throw him on late and try and make something happen option at central midfield. And there isn't really depth behind this that I'm talking about that you want to see in this camp. Most likely, if there's a replacement here for Osorio, it's Liam Fraser. He's playing in the second division in Europe. That's not really an angle you want to go. So this has gone really quickly from confidence to worrying for Canada. And then you throw on top of that some players moving clubs. Kyle Larin hasn't played. He hasn't been a starter. Richie Larea didn't play at Nottingham Forest, has probably recovered most of his form. But again, only two more games with TFC for him going into the World Cup. Danielle Henry now taking this injury, which I actually don't think is a negative because I actually think Joel Waterman's a better player at this point and could be a better player for this national team, as well as some other pieces that have struggled or been hurt. So there's more question marks, as we said, than there was before. The big ones around Atiba, even if he gets there, there's no way he can start three games in a week. So you're still looking at needing options in that central midfield space. And if Osorio's hurt, that changes the 10. It maybe changes the formation. There's a lot of question marks, especially in that area.
What a raving review from from the top team in CONCACAF. You made them seem like they didn't qualify for the World Cup. I'm high on this Canadian team. I think they're going to surprise a lot of people, and I think they get out of their group.
Let me read you some quotes here, Charlie. Because Dave's not the only one. I don't know. He's sounding an alarm here. I'm not saying John Herdman is sounding alarms, but he's standing next to it. He's like, the break if necessary might apply here. Quote, there's things happening here that have been super positive. Goes to what you said, Charlie. And some things that, yeah, they're keeping me up at night. Nah, not exactly what you want to hear. He's talking about sort of the transition from CONCACAF. And they figured things out in CONCACAF. And we're obviously the story of the region. No doubt about that. What they were able to do in qualifying was incredible. But he says, hey, in the meantime, with June kind of screwed up with all the negotiations and the stop-start that they had there, they started to dig into this transition from regional to global and world football, the best in the world at the World Cup. He says, we are moving into a new jungle, which is world football. And then we're also sharing in the reality that, in the last 6 or 7 World Cups, there's only 3 teams that have broken out of the group stage with only 3 tier 1 players. So what you're saying is it's possible, Charlie, but the facts are telling you that it's near impossible. So we've got to be ready to do things differently.
Who's tier 1 for the U.S. Women's National Team in 2002? In your mind, who's tier 1?
I mean, clearly Claudio was.
Claudio Reyna, yeah.
Brad Friedel was.
Ryan may have been.
I would argue that O'Brien was on the verge. I would argue that Eddie Pope was on the verge.
Was Brian McBride already in England?
No, he wasn't.
Okay.
He had been there on loan, but I don't know. I'm not sure I entirely buy John Herdman's.
No, the whole tier one theory, throw that thing out in the trash. What I will say though, is in terms of how they lined up against Mexico, in their home match when they won 2-1, it was a 3-4-3. And the 3-4 is a very defensive 7 players and your outside wing backs in Larea and Adekube, they're naturally right back, left back, and they're playing in an advanced role. And you just counter the hell out of teams with Alphonso Davies and Tejan Buchanan, who will be any, well, most people
who has, in a been, counter has situation. Been hurt, has not played this year for Bruce,
yeah, but he's back. Training. So yeah,
he's back. Okay.
I'm yeah.
Just saying, just information.
September 21st. So, sure. They, yeah. You know, yeah, you got over a month and a half.
60 days. We established that.
Oh, so 60 days.
Laren, and then you had Laren up top, who again hasn't played every single match, but you have Jonathan David also. So you counter with three players, defend with the seven. I like their chances. As long as they have another strong defensive performance like they did in CONCACAF, this team will hurt Morocco. They will hurt Belgium. They will hurt Croatia while playing in this system. And I think it's pretty flexible. You have players who can play. Alphonso Davies can also play defensive, play left back. He can play a left wing back. Tejan Buchanan can play all over. You can line up with two strikers. Depending the scenario within the game, I think Herdman's pretty open to just changing at the drop of a dime. So I like Canada. I really do think that they're as much as the stuff is going around with the team right now in negative light, I think they turn around for Qatar.
I think Charlie, it's playing dead a little bit, huh?
No, Charlie, I
like Canada too. Welcome.
But to John Herdman's point, the worst game they played in qualifying was the first game they played in the final round of World Cup qualifying. The step up is an experience. They lost the camp in June. They're going to get a friendly against Uruguay in a neutral site in Bratislava, which isn't going to be exactly Belgium in a World Cup. And then you go into the World Cup, and if Atiba Hutchinson's not playing day in and day out, and Richie Larea hasn't played for most of this year, and you start talking about all the pieces in that team, Kyle Laren scored in those big games. He does not start for his club right now. It starts to be more worrying than it was when they qualified. And so now you're saying, can you make the jump in one game with no room for error against the best team or one of the five best teams in the world for the first time ever without being at your best? And that's where the question marks come. And that's where it feels differently than, I agree with you. When the draw happened, I was like, ha ha ha, all of you are about to learn. But it's in a worse position now than it was then.
They're in the group of death. So, of course, the expectation is, oh, it's going to be really tough. You're taking a huge step up. But I think there's no pressure on Canada to get out of the group. So when you're looking at Croatia and Belgium in particular, I'd say, yeah, everyone expects them to go out. So I think it plays right into Canada's hand, defend and counter, and there'll be opportunities. They just have to be a hope that everyone's fit and then they execute.
So we talked about the 26 for the U.S. and sort of this purgatory zone, you might call it, of guys that could be in, could be out. They're sort of sitting on the fence right now. It'll come down to form, coach's decision, etc. John Herdman, another quote from him, this isn't a do or die camp for players. There's a lot of moving parts at this point, and that includes dual internationals, Dave. So what are the moving parts, do you think, for Canada?
I think all of the conversations are on the low end of the roster, or, you know, obviously most of the starters and the locked in players are all who you'd expect they would be. Liam Miller comes back into this camp after being injured. That's a guy who's pushing in. We thought they might give a call up to Mitrovic. Sounds like he's committing to Serbia, so he won't be coming into this group. Theo Corbinu gets in after playing really well in the championship. It feels like he's a guy who can win a spot, especially if someone else gets hurt. And I think him coming into this camp is sort of a reflection of just being the unknown with Tejan Buchanan and pieces like that. So those are some of the big ones. The two dual nationals where you talk about, okay, do you sort of bring someone who's maybe not ready because it's the back end of the roster, and can you sort of build for the future? It's obviously Luka Koliosho, who's in this camp, has not played yet because of the mess that was June, is not cap tied yet, is available for the U.S. and Canada, playing a little bit at Espanyol. That's the big one who seems to be on the verge of being on this team. It's risky, though. And then the other one, of course, is Daniel Jevison, who accepted a call up to the England U20 team for this window. He's been pretty open about saying, I love my Canadian heritage. I love being from Canada. I'm proud of it. I'd love to play for them. My first option is England. But I think all of us can remember a coach bringing a player to a World Cup with a promise to try and get them on a national team. I will say this, that doesn't feel very Herdman. When you look at the race for Marcelo Flores and the things Tata Martino was willing to guarantee and give him before he was even a pro player, that Herdman wasn't. And when you look at the way Herdman has valued loyalty, especially from players who have been around this process, because if you remember, Jonathan David and Atiba Hutchinson weren't coming back to play in Bridgeview, Illinois to start qualifying in the middle of COVID. It was Lucas Cavallini. It was Daniil Henry. It was Kamal Miller. It was these guys. He's continued to give players like that call-ups all the way through. And I think you even see it with Greg Berhalter with the weird timing and the camps. I think there's a lot of value on continuity, culture, and loyalty right now. And I'd be surprised if Herdman went with a curveball right at the end and risked some of that. But Daniel Jevison's a borderline, you know, England national team player. That's a talent that you have to consider.
We'll see what he decides. As it stands, Jevison not in this camp. The roster for Canada has two matches. They need him. Qatar and Uruguay coming up on Friday and Tuesday. The U.S. also in action, obviously Japan and Saudi Arabia. For those of you watching on YouTube, we've got a treat for you. For those of you listening on the podcast, you should probably go to YouTube for this one. We've got Matt Doyle here breaking down the different striker options Greg Berhalter has and how they might affect U.S. style of play. All right. Thank you, Doyle, for putting that together. Thank you for everybody listening on the podcast who immediately paused, went to YouTube, watched that, and are obviously now back listening to us wherever it is that you are. I'll mention it again just in case you somehow forgot. There's only two of these left. I mean, I guess three, depending on what you get ahead of the World Cup in that short week. We've got Friday action, U.S. very early in the morning. Make some coffee, make some breakfast, come watch it with Charlie, Michael Parkhurst, and I. 8:25 a.m. Eastern Time, ESPN2, ESPN Plus, Unimas, and Tudian. We'll be live watching the game with you on Twitch and YouTube. Come shoot a question their way. We've got a striker with a lot of USMNT experience, as well as a defender on both sides. Can give you some insight on what they're seeing on the field and what they see from this team ahead of Qatar. And Canada obviously playing at 1 p.m. Eastern on One Soccer. That's Canada only against Qatar. Coverage of that on MLSsoccer.com as well. Tuesday, Canada, Uruguay. At noon Eastern, One Soccer once again, and then Saudi Arabia, USA, 2 p.m. Eastern, FS1, Unimas, Tudian. We have another watch along for that as well on YouTube,
Charlie,
and Twitch.
If I rush ship it, will you wear a t-shirt that says Rhode Island's a suburb of Boston on Friday's show?
I would.
Oh, yes. Oh, boy. All right. Good aside. Great aside there. Let's get into that U.S. game.
Anything Japan. For New England.
What was that? That was like,
it was a classic New England accent.
I was going to say, Shalree's been in New England for a long time, so maybe there's a little combo there.
Yeah, I've not seen Spotlight.
Yeah, man. My love, New England Revolution.
Okay. Charlie, you were chomping at the bit to give us your lineups against Japan. And we asked for two, actually. I want yours, but then I want to understand what you think Greg Berhalter is going to do differently than what you might.
Yes. So my ideal starting 11 for Japan would be Sam Vines at left back, natural left back. He's doing it for the top team in Belgium. No Anthony Robinson. Let Vines go out there and see how he's progressed. I'd like to see Mark McKenzie as the left center back and Walker Zimmerman as the right center back, because Mark McKenzie has just gotten over the hump. He's had to kind of get into the trenches battle, continue to kind of get 1 minute here, one game here, one start here. It hasn't worked out. Finally, he builds his confidence back up. They sell the center back that's playing in front of him, and now he's solidified himself, and the team's on an incredible run. With him starting, they have not lost. And then Serginho Dest at right back. You know, he's got his move to Milan. He's getting some time. I'd like to see where he is. Then we have Tyler Adams, defensive midfielder, Weston McKennie, with no Yunus Musah, which I'm most disappointed because he is my favorite player to watch. I would like to see Brendan Aaronson in this attacking midfield role because he's showing he can do it in the Premier League. He can play central. He can get out wide and put Gio Reyna on the right wing spot, because Gio Reyna's now, he's played considerable minutes as a substitute. Both times players in front of him get injured, he's forced to come in the first half. He can play. So I'd like to see how they rotate and work together. And then left wing, Christian Pulisic. And then You got to get the keys to Jesus Ferreira right now. He's balling. He's playing well. He knows how this front three works, how the midfield works. Want to see how he can be a little bit more dangerous and see how he's progressed since his last outing with the U.S. men's national team.
Obviously, Matt Turner in goal. Sort of established that one. Now, you know, compare and contrast here. What do you think will actually happen? What will Greg put on the field, in your opinion?
I think it's going to be Turner in goal. Sam Vines, Aaron Long, because I think he's always valued Aaron Long and always valued that partnership with Long and Zimmerman. It goes back a long ways. I think Serginho Dest, Adams, McKinney, and then in this attacking midfield role with McKinney, I think this midfielder has got to be a little bit more apt to attack. I think he's going to play Luca Della Torre. Malik Tillman maybe could push his way in because he's just been playing for Rangers. And then I think he's going to go Aaronson right wing, Christian Pulisic left wing, and then I think he's still going to stick with Jesus Ferrer as well up top.
What do you think, Doyle? How do you feel about those two lineups from Charlie?
I'd be happy to see either of those. I don't love Brendan Aaronson as a number 10. I don't love him centrally because he just doesn't find the ball enough. He could play it for Leeds, right? And he could play it for Salzburg because their game model is just so vastly different. Whereas with Berhalter, the game model, those central midfielders need to be all over the ball. They need to get a ton of it. So I like that would be my one quibble, but I'm not against seeing it, right? Like let's see if, especially because the U.S. went to that 4-2-3-1 over the summer against Uruguay and against Morocco. He flipped the triangle. It wasn't a single pivot anymore. It was Musa playing next to Tyler Adams. Well, I do think there is value in seeing if Weston can play next to Tyler in a two, mm-hmm. and then put either Aaronson or Reyna or Tillman as the one underneath whoever the center forward happens to be, whether it's Ferreira or Sargent or Pepe. As for the Long versus Mark McKenzie thing, look, I like Mark McKenzie. I think he has a higher upside than Aaron Long, but it's a game model thing. Aaron Long's just, he's a better athlete and he's better in the air. And like he is the closest thing in this group that there is to Miles Robinson. Because we all know if Miles Robinson hadn't done his Achilles, he would be the starter next to Zimmerman in these games. So I don't think that Greg Berhalter wants to change the game model. So I do expect Aaron Long to get the first look. But I do hope that we get to see 90 minutes of Mark McKenzie because he can elevate what this team does in terms of distribution from the back. But with all of it, the thing that matters most to me, I need to see Sam Fiennes. I need to see him at left back because he looked overwhelmed and he looked scared the last time he played for the U.S., which he was a 21-year-old. I remember Anthony Robinson looking kind of overwhelmed and scared for the U.S. playing at the same age. Young players in good situations get better. As Charlie pointed out, Sam Fiennes is starting every game, going 90 minutes every game for the best team in Belgium. That's a young player in a good situation. I expect him to go out in these two games and show that he's a better player than he was the last time he wore the red, white, and blue. And I'm keeping my fingers crossed that's enough for him to push into the final 26-man roster.
And we always talked about Serginho Dest being able to play left back. I don't want to see him at left back. Amen. I don't think anyone wants to see him at left back because of his natural tendency is to play on his right side. He's not going to provide width. Now with Reyna and Aaronson, if they're on that right side, that allows Serginho Dest to stay wide, stay high. And those two can combine the movement between Reyna and Aaronson, I think will allow the U.S. to be a little bit more dynamic with Dest playing so high. So interchanging is on point, I think, with Reyna and Aaronson. I think that movement would be phenomenal.
Are we going to talk about the elephant in the room, which is that maybe Christian Pulisic with this group is not a locked-in starter anymore? Aaronson's been better than him in the Premier League. Reyna, now that he's getting fit again, he's starting to look like a guy who I would want in the starting 11 every single game. I know Pulisic is supposed to be our best player, but he's playing so poorly, even when he gets on the field, Charlie. And we can't blame Thomas Tuchel anymore, right? Like, Graham Potter played him at wingback the other day, too.
Yeah, it hurts. I mean, when you're out of form, you're out of confidence, you're out of confidence. I mean, we've seen Fernando Torres, who is the top striker in his time, go to Chelsea and with no confidence looks lost. I mean, that just happens to players. So I think you just hope by that time he's found himself again. But I don't think anyone thinks he won't be starting come the first game.
So you think he's written in pen as a starter?
I do.
Does anybody think otherwise?
No, and I think it's less about, I wouldn't even use the phrase our best player now. I've said this a few times. I think he's the leader. I think Greg Berhalter looks at him as the leader, and I think the other players in that generation do as well. And I don't think you're going to step on the field for the first World Cup game in 8 years without Christian Pulisic.
I agree. Can I ask you this? And I didn't want to, but now I have to, Charlie. You haven't written. Did you write a book, Charlie?
I have not.
I guess I could offer to be your ghostwriter, but then I wouldn't be the ghostwriter anymore.
I've tinkered with it.
Tinkered.
Yes.
Well, Christian did write a book. What do you think about this story that's come out in the pre-release with the story with Thomas Tuchel? I'm just curious as your perspective as a former player.
I think it happens to every player at that level. And even under that level, that it happens with a coach. A coach tells you one thing, you don't play. You come into a meal room, you're expecting to start, and your name's not on the starting 11, or vice versa. You don't expect to start, and you see your name on the starting 11. But I think more importantly, you feel that maybe you've earned it, or you've had that relationship, and all of a sudden you're on the outside looking in. That happens all the time. I think to write about it, that. Typically that doesn't happen because you're burning bridges, and you never know in this game. He could end up at a club where it's already talking about Thomas Tuchel maybe takes over Bayern Munich if they decide to part ways. So if Bayern Munich happened, he had an opportunity to go to Bayern Munich. Do you think that would be a good thing? Or if there was a club that had an opening and Thomas Tuchel had some sort of involvement, I just don't think you ever right during your playing days for that reason, because things can get complicated. You're talking about teammates, what you've seen, some interactions that, you know, if they are negative, it could cause a rift in a lot of different ways. So I was a little shocked to see that. I mean, I think everyone can read through the lines when you see Christian score goals here or play here and he's not playing all of a sudden. It's because the manager doesn't trust him for whatever reason or doesn't like him. And that's it. Everyone can see that. But to come out and say that, I would have said, release that book when you're done playing.
Also, Rooney did this too. You're going to write a book at 23 years old? Listen, there's geniuses out there with things to say. That's great. But I don't know how much you really have to say at that point. I have nothing to say, and I'm 10 years older than that.
Let the story play out kind of thing?
Yeah. Hey, I was young. I liked soccer. Yeah. Now I'm a soccer player. Okay, great. A story arc. That sounds like a short story. I could do a children's book.
That's the beginning of the story. There's a lot of chapters to add onto that book later on, some addendums perhaps, and hopefully a really positive one for this World Cup for Christian Pulisic and the U.S. We're looking at Japan, obviously, and then Saudi Arabia. Last question. Do you think that Greg will rotate significantly, or will we see a very similar team in both games?
I would say similar team in both games. You're trying to build continuity, a rhythm, even though, you know, it's just two games and you're not going to see each other again until November. I still think you stick with the same team, essentially, unless you make one or two changes, but predominantly the same team, just to get an idea. And you make substitutions based on fitness and fatigue.
I think it'll be the same core. I think it'll be more than two changes. I think all those question mark positions,
left back, center back,
center forward, and probably the third center mid, I think all of them will get rotated. But you'll walk out and say, yeah, of course, Walker Zimmerman, Sergiño Dest, Matt Turner. I think they'll all have started both games.
Do we all expect to see the single pivot or the double pivot?
I would expect it to be the single pivot. I wouldn't be shocked if Kellen starts one of the games because Tyler's playing every week now.
So just to rest Tyler.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still think back to that interview Berhalter gave during June, during that last camp, when he was asked why, and he said Tyler came up short with some of the stuff that we wanted to do in terms of distributing as a single pivot. And he doesn't play as a single pivot for Leeds, you know, and he didn't do that really for either of the Red Bull teams that he played for. You know, we all like he's the most irreplaceable player on the team, but he also has like very obvious limitations in terms of the ability to receive in traffic on the half turn.
Oh, we don't want him doing that. Just stick to his strengths.
Right. But that's why it goes to the double pivot, right? Like that's what part of June was like, okay, let's get Musa on the same line as him because Musa is so great at ball progression.
But there's no Musa.
I mean, De La Torre was great at ball progression
McKennie as well at that time. A healthy fit McKennie. So I think Weston's better served as a more defensive midfielder than an attacking midfielder. And you could have Musa play the higher of the three just because now he's centrally for Valencia and he's involved in the final third. I've been so pleased with his progression. So
We
see it completely different, Charlie. I don't care if Moose is good or bad in the final third. I care about the fact that he's so good at getting the ball to the final third and making sure that the likes of Pulisic and Reyna and McKennie can get on it in rhythm. You know, whereas with Wes, he's so great at those box arriving runs and he's so dominant in the air. Like, I want him arriving for that. But one of the big tests, if it is the double pivot, is okay. Let's see if Wes can drop back and play that Musa role where he's got to be clean on the ball. He's got to turn out of pressure. He's got to drive the ball upfield. And then that opens a chance for someone to play as like kind of a modern number 10. I think that's one of I'm not saying I'm more interested in this than the personnel stuff, but no, I am. I'm more interested in this than I am the personnel stuff. I think the shape of the U.S. national team in these two games, irrespective of what, you know, Japan and Saudi Arabia throw at us is going to be absolutely fascinating to pick apart.
I know Weston McKennie played in that role for Schalke a couple times in some big games, but he likes to risk things in possession. Yeah. It's one of the things that makes him great because he tries things. It's one of the things that I think probably holds him back from being in that role. He will take risks. He will lose the ball. And if it's just him as the deep man playing out, that opens you up.
Yeah.
We shall see. First game for the U.S., bright and early on Friday morning. Still debating, do I go waffles? Do I go eggs? What am I going to go with? Can I wake up in time to make any of this? Because the game is at 8:25 a.m. Eastern time in Dusseldorf, Germany. ESPN2, ESPN Plus, Unimas Tudien. We will have a live watch.
Do it, Doyle. Correct.
Did he say Dusseldorf?
Correct.
Dusseldorf.
That's the can.
I'm not that. Right, the umlaut throws me off. Okay. I read without the umlaut, I'm okay. All right.
It's okay. We all love you, Weeby.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thanks for the nice pat on the back, Charlie. Like, okay, go to the corner, buddy.
You're the man manager.
Headed to the corner right now. We'll have that watch along with Charlie. I'll figure it out before Friday, all right? With Charlie and Michael Parkhurst. Come hang out with us. Ask some questions in the chat as well. We'll answer any questions you got. And then obviously Saudi Arabia on Tuesday. For Canada, it's going to be Qatar and then Uruguay. A couple World Cup participants. Qatar on Friday, 1 p.m. Eastern, 1 soccer. That's just in Canada. Dave, take us through the starting 11. Is it that you hope for or that you think Herdman will go for some combination of the two?
It's a combination of the two. I think it's more towards the Herdman lineup. A lot of it's pretty obvious because you missed the camps in June. It's going to be their best 11s, and the places you're moving are the question marks, but it's different than the U.S., I think. And I would remind you, because I had to tell Charlie before, this is a pretty good Qatar team. It's not a team to laugh about, even though everyone plays in Qatar and no one watches the league. This is a team that's played as a team over the last 4 years rather than playing for their clubs. And they're fairly dangerous than Uruguay, as we said, is going to be the best team Canada's faced in 4 years. I think it's Milan Borjan in goal. That's unquestionable. Maxime Crépeau hasn't done enough to displace him. Even if he did, it's probably still Milan. And then you've got the three center backs, Kamal Miller, Steven Vitoria, and Alistair Johnston, even though he's played really well at wing back for CF Montreal, which I do think will be a factor in this World Cup, in this Canada team, potentially using him there. I think Richie Larea earned his spot back, especially with Tejan. Herdman's comments were wrapping him in cotton. I don't know. You're definitely not going to start him from a situation like that. And then Sam Adekube was the unsung hero of World Cup qualifying. He gets to start at left wing back. Marc-Anthony Kay and Eustáquio, as I said, that's the pairing you need to see if Kay is ready at the international level. That's the risk you take. And I think that it's, a 10 and then two forwards in front. This is what I'm guessing for right now. Junior Hoylett started every game for Reading. It's been at wingback, but he has played at that 10 role for for John Herdman, and you are missing, as we said, a lot of pieces, and that would leave Alphonso Davies and Jonathan David up top. That's what I think we'll see. What I would like to see probably would be take Alphonso Davies, put him as that 10, and he's played as a roaming 10 for them, and start Kyle Larin. Because even in moments where Kyle Larin wasn't playing for Besiktas, and he came back and played with the national team, he played at a high level. I think he's influential because of his flexibility, how he can support David and Davies. But I wouldn't be shocked if he doesn't get a start, especially in the first game, coming off the run he's had in Belgium.
Any thoughts, Doyle, Charlie?
Yeah, I would say the unsung hero is most definitely for me and this Canada team, Alistair Johnston or Kamal Miller. Just because they've been consistent. Alistair Johnston has played that right center back role all throughout qualifying and was just was awesome for them. Was absolutely awesome. It just steady, consistent, and the same thing when he go in MLS when Nashville left him, traded him to Montreal. They I guess didn't really value what he brought to that team. They struggled mightily without him. It took them a long time to adjust. And in the same breath, he made Montreal that much better. And Kamal Miller at the same in the same area has really improved his game on the ball. Sometimes a little too casual for my liking, but he has improved tremendously with his tactics and just awareness playing in the back. So, man, I love Tejan Buchanan, just what he brings, that edge and his pace, the one-on-one confidence, how he can open up a game. So yeah, bubble wrap him until November. I am 100% with him on that. Davies and David, Jonathan David. I know Laren's a great goal scorer and has helped this team out tremendously. But I think come World Cup, if Laren continues to sit the bench in Belgium, I think he comes off the bench. He's not starting for Canada, and I think you have Davies and Laren, and you play with three, and those three just attack, and you sit with those two midfielders, Eustachio and Hutchinson, if Atiba is good to go.
I would add Ikpe Ugbo, who has scored for Troyes, now full-time Ligue 1 player, as a potential at that forward position. The other thing I'd say about Tejan is, if you remember down at the Azteca, they technically started a flat four with Alistair Johnson as the right back, and Tejan out wide. So it's a little bit different, but I agree with Charlie in that if Tejan's available, I think he's on the field. And if he is, you have Alistair Johnson to be a flexible, quote-unquote, right center back, right back.
Chad is dragging you right now for your pronunciation of a
French. I'm sorry. Tell France to come tell that to my face. Then I'll respect them.
This is a guy who claims to love Montreal. Listen to him.
He didn't even know it was an island.
I don't have to worry about my colonial overlords from hundreds of years ago.
Okay. Charlie, you played in France. Give us the correct pronunciation of the team that David just called Troyes.
Troyes.
Did I ask?
Okay. We still love
Ma and tell Goss, me
we love you,
Dave. It's you and I. It's you and I against them. It's you and I against them. All right.
We know we love you.
Yeah.
Meet you in Dusseldorf. We'll see it out there.
Oh boy, Japan, U.S. On Friday, 8:25 a.m. Right Eastern Time. ESPN2, ESPN+.
Unimas, I forgot what I cared about. Live watch along. God, this
Charlie
is
Davies and Michael Parkhurst and myself. And then, of course, U.S. against Saudi Arabia on Tuesday. Canada's going to play Qatar on Friday, and then they'll play Uruguay on Tuesday. And then that's basically it till November. As of today, September 21st.
How many days away are we?
60 days.
Whoa!
Thank you.
60 Actually, days. Aren't you wrong about that? Didn't they adjust it one day?
Did they? I just literally Googled. I Googled how many days in the World Cup, and it said 60 days. So I blame Google. All right, that's it. More Club and Country Qatar 2022 to come. We will see you on Friday, everybody. Enjoy your week.